Welcome, travelers. I'm Josh.
I'm Glenn.
And I'm Lee Wanika, and this is Tabletop Journeys, where we will be your not-so-humble guides on the quest for RPG adventures.
Here at Tabletop Journeys, we are all devoted role players and storytellers at heart, and we absolutely love sharing our passion with you. On our show, we feature diverse tabletop RPG systems, demonstrating them through actual plays and breaking down the rules to provide you with tips, tools, and techniques to help you navigate them. We also love bringing the content creators behind these games into the studio to give you a peek behind the curtain with relevant and insightful interviews.
Let us help you get the most out of your story, no matter what game world or system you're playing, because detailed settings, heroic characters, diverse NPCs, and a focus on story over rules can make any campaign legendary. Now, here's a message from friends of the show.
Hi, I'm Conan Librarian, and I don't have a podcast. I do, however, like most of us, have the need for a place to store, organize, customize, and create my tabletop campaigns, thoughts, and ideas. That's why you should check out obsidianportal.com. Customization that will match any need you have, a fantastic community, and an experience in and of itself that will get your players engaged, not just during the session. ObsidianPortal.com. Your players don't just stay at the tavern. Why should your game just stay at the table? ObsidianPortal.com.
Welcome, everybody, to tonight's episode. I'm very happy to be sitting across the microphone from the one, the only, the inimitable, the slightly shorter in real life than he is on video, Mr. Lee Wanika Miller. My friend, how the hell are you tonight? It doesn't feel like it's been that long since we recorded, but yet I think it has been. Last week was a weird week.
Yeah, last week was very odd. So it has been a bit since we've recorded, but it hasn't been all that long since I've been recording. Over the week, I was actually, or just last night, I did Old Ways to Spiro with Benito on Spectre Studios' YouTube channel. Got to play my character for that game, M'Shale. Had a great time. Had this great battle. I had the whole adventure was an awesome battle. And then following it, got some bad news. I won't give too many spoilers, but my character had a really nice scene trying to deal with some of the losses. And then there was an awesome roleplay scene that I wasn't even directly involved in. I actually just got to watch a player, and we're definitely going to talk about this at some point. I need to bring this up in future episode. But I watched a player I've known for quite a while have a scene with an old friend of mine as well. And in that scene, it was probably one of the best scenes I've ever been a part of for a player playing a warlock trying to convince somebody to join their patron. Like, that bit of recruitment was a masterclass in what I think a warlock should be. It has altered my perspective on the entirety of that class.
If this wasn't a Greystoke that would have happily jumped onto the tip of the spear in that case to go ahead and do evil, they actually took some convincing, maybe some cajoling, that maybe the patron wasn't actually, I don't know, about to go ahead and bring an apocalypse upon not just one but two different worlds, and that hypothetically Greystoke would be leading the charge once again.
Great. I've never played a Greystoke warlock, so I wouldn't know. And a Greystoke would absolutely not have entertained this particular thing. That player was smart enough to not bring that information to a Greystoke.
HK did, but that's okay.
We digress. We're here for other things.
That's right. I suppose HK didn't do it intentionally because he wasn't smart enough to figure it out in time. That's right. My bad. But you're right. My bad. I digress. It's been a crazy week. At the point that we are recording this, I have just recently left my 9-to-5, which to join the business that my wife and I are building, which is full of interesting opportunity and everything like that. And just coming the new norm. I've been in technology for 25 years, I realized. So it's been a long time since I have not had to get up for a 9 o'clock meeting on Monday, something that I have with good humor continued to go ahead and point out to you at 9 o'clock every day, I think in the last week. But yeah, there's just a lot of stuff going on in home, trying to go ahead and get the writing and editing done on not one, but two projects that we're bringing to fruition here, probably within the next month or so. Yeah, just a lot going on. And if we can, for just a brief moment here, shout out to co-host Mr. Glenn Myers, who we can play Where is Glenn Tonight? Because we know that he's still down in Virginia dealing with storms and things, which are knocking out his internet, making him unavailable to join us this evening. So you had received a question or fielded a question online and had thrown a topic onto our topic board to go ahead and record an episode tonight. And that's what we're going to talk about. So set me up. What is it that we're going to be talking tonight?
Yeah, essentially, I was on Reddit. And while I don't always find great material in Reddit to bring up in question, a lot of times I find meme-worthy information or information that we will chat about, say, hey, look at this nonsense or what have you. But in this particular case, it was a really good question. I have reached out to the individual, and I hope at some point that they chime onto the show, because these are the kinds of questions we would like to have in our comment section as well, because it was a really good question. It comes from r/DND, and that's the group, yeah. And the individual,
that's the name of the forum,
that's the forum, and the name of the individual is Sign of Souls 1395, and essentially it was about DMing as the key on this particular thread. And his question, the big bold, is my player wants to have a god for a parent.
Mm-hmm.
He goes on to explain, I'm running a Norse pantheon-inspired homebrew campaign for my party, and one of my players wants to have a goddess for a parent. I'm totally on board with this, and I think a party quest line of trying to ascend a player to godhood sounds really cool. The issue I'm running into is that I'm trying to decide how to give him abilities that come from his parentage, but also keep them in check, if that makes sense. Any tips? Now, there were a whole bunch of people that really liked this question. There was a whole slew of answers. I actually had one answer at the time, and then in the days or so following it, I went back to the forum, copied it, and put it in our discussion bin. Beyond answering his specific question, which I would like for both of us to do tonight, I also wanted to get behind that question and really dig into, what does a GM do when players are engaged in a game, but the background ask is crazy pants? Just not making sense, whether it's because I as a GM don't grok it, or because it's just weird, or doesn't fit
in with the world vision thematically, or something like that.
There's so many different reasons for it, but what does a GM do? So I really think that's the core question beyond his question, but I really liked his question, and I was interested in your answer to that kind of question. So I'll let you go first, and then I'll fill the audience in on what I typed in and answer to.
Thankfully, I know what your answer is. So if I just parrot your answer back to you, does that mean I get to steal your answer?
No, you cannot snake my answer because it's sitting in front of you at this moment. That would be poor form, sir.
I could, and nobody would be the wiser. I could just pretend like I happen to know the person that does the editing on this particular episode, so I could just make it sound like I have this like font of wisdom that I'm reading from.
I appreciate you, before you've actually gotten to the point where the audience hears my answer, telling me how great my answer is. Folks, I'm done here. I don't need to do a single other episode. Josh has agreed. I'm a genius. I'm out.
Even a blind squirrel finds a nut, my friend. Like that's yeah. So I will not steal your answer then, because I do really like your answer, but I want to go a different direction with it. Specifically, the question that he's asking is about how to balance powers, right? How to make the character have access to or gain powers because of this connection to the deity that they're trying to go ahead and write into their background. If we're talking about D&D specifically, and let's stay in D&D for now because that's the game that's being asked about. I think that when I'm talking about player powers, I'm looking at class options. I'm not looking at anything else. There are other directions that you can go, but I'm thinking class options because I'm thinking if I'm a paladin, that's how I'm getting my powers. If I'm a ranger, theoretically, that's how I'm getting powers. If I'm a bard, that's how I'm getting powers, blah, 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 right? So if this character were coming to me and said, here's what's in my background and I want to go ahead and get some sort of mechanical benefit to this, I would say I can think of two options right off the top of my head. Play whatever race, whatever species, whatever lineage you want, have at it. Are you going to be a cleric of this deity, or are you going to be a warlock of this deity? And then start talking about what their relationship is and how the patron relationship. I would lean warlock. Maybe I'm just like seeing some parallels in here that, mom, can I have access to can I have something other than Eldritch Blast, please? That kind of thing. But I think that is the sort of vehicle that gives a storyteller the ability, no pun intended, but the ability to go ahead and feed powers to that player in a way that is narratively strongest, right? Because as a storyteller, so sure, like clerics and warlocks both have the same sort of mechanic for learning spells and for gaining powers and stuff like that. But there's nothing that ever says that a storyteller has to go ahead and follow those rules as the maximum. They can always follow those rules as if they are the minimum, right? So especially if you're playing a warlock with the kind of the very specific character patron relationship that a warlock has, there's nothing that says that you can't say, oh, you're in a particularly tense situation right now. Here you go. Here's a little push. Here's a little Benny. What do you think about that? How do you like that little touch of power? Maybe it allows you to steer that warlock in a particular direction. And I think if you're talking about a goddess, which is apparently meddling in the lives of humans anyway, since she has born a child that is on this planet, so to speak, then I think that playing a meddling goddess in that way, that is the patron of a warlock, allows you to go ahead and give a little bit of push and pull that says, oh, you know what? You think you're Pact of the Blade? Maybe you're something else. Exactly. And so it allows you to go ahead and nudge that, oh, you think you're getting Eldritch Blast? No, you're not getting Eldritch Blast. You're getting Magic Missile instead. Not a warlock spell, but whatever. Like, it allows you to give different flavored things that have narrative weight to that character, and it allows you to go ahead and kind of mess with them a little bit. And that's really, at the end of the day, I think that a character that is asking to go ahead and be related specifically to one of the deities in the game, what they are asking for is they're saying, storyteller, I'm giving you a little bit of stuff. I want you to mess with me a little bit. Maybe they don't know that they're asking that question, but that is certainly the way that I interpret it when somebody asks to go ahead and do that. So I think that's maybe the direction that I would try to convince them to go. I would dangle that carrot. We were talking about Benito earlier in the show, much like when Augustus, child of Azarian, was coming up, and I was like, hey, Ben, I just happened to buy this book, and it's got these new dumb fear, these half-vampire lineages in it. Aren't these pretty cool? He's like, wait, what do you mean done? He's like, no, Augustus is a dumb fear now. Thank you very much. I was like, well, no, I wasn't even asking. That's not what I wanted. No, too late. It's already done. So,
I was not a fly on the wall when that took place, Josh. Yeah. But now I really want to have been.
It was brilliant. And so that's very much kind of the direction that I would go with it, is I would be like, I'm going to dangle this thing in front of you. And you think that it's a carrot, but it's also a stick. I'm going to beat you over the head with it a little bit. And I'm going to steer your character in directions that maybe you don't want it to go, or maybe you didn't think you wanted it to go, but it's going to be a whole lot of fun. I'm going to dangle this and see if you want to go on a journey with me and hope that the player bites. I think that's the direction that I would go with it, though. And if they wanted to go the boring route, they could go cleric, like whatever, that's fine. You get powers from your deity and everything's fine. But really, if I could go ahead and tempt them with warlock, I think that there's a little bit more narrative weight behind that.
I absolutely love your answer. Love it. And to be fair, I think my answer was good, and it is the thing that I came up with first, but I like your answer much better. Yeah. I would take your answer a wee bit further, though.
Yeah.
I would add Paladin to that option. There are a couple different subclasses that would work really well. I would also add Sorcerer as an option because there are a couple different Sorcerer subclasses that would work. Specifically, the Celestial version of the Sorcerer is the one that Chief comes to mind, but there are others that could work as well. Depending on who the goddess is, even a Draconic Sorcerer might work. So I think any of the Sorcerers could be narratively described.
It really depends who the deity is. The Archfey would work. That's
hey, all. If the deity in question was one of the Elfine, then Archfey would be textbook written, right? Yeah. I would also take it one other step, and I think this does not drastically alter what happens in the game, but the GM may have to do a little bit of refiguring at the lower tier to account for it as far as combat encounter construction and adventure construction, which is if the party each had a bonus feat. So even if you had a human who gets their starter feat, a variant human who gets their starter feat, but if you gave every party member an extra feat, regardless of how they built their characters, but this character got a feat that reflected that deity in some fashion. And there could be any number of feats that would work, again, depending on who the deity is, or maybe you construct one that something that basically provide some kind of radiant accoutrement to their character in some fashion or what have you. Yep. I think those would be really that would be a nice way to also reflect and still maintain that player character balance. It does cause, like I said, a little bit of work on the GM's part to follow up. So I think that's the one thing I would add to yours as an additional dial that could be turned to amp up a bit of that. But I love classes as the answer to the question.
Yeah. I think if we're going to open up to feats also, we could all talk about like magic items where certain characteristics of the magic item awaken as the player advances. So maybe it's just a sword to start. And then maybe once they get to like level 4, level 5, it gains a +1 or it gains a ribbon ability of some sort or something like that. And maybe by tier 3, the sword starts talking to them. That's like that sort of thing. Again, find a way to, I'm going to put reward in air quotes, but to reward them for their hubris in asking for such a thing. Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. So what was your answer then?
My answer was really very basic in that it went back to one of the core character types, species of the 2014 game, and then one of the subsequent species that was brought in later books. But the answer was make the character an ASMR or a tiefling, depending on the type of deity. If it's an evil deity, tiefling. If it's benign, and we're talking Norse, so you could go either way, doesn't matter. But basically, pick the type that matches your flavor. Those who are more on the Odin side of things might be one way. Those who are more on the Sutur side of things might be another. I think just take that. Natural abilities, mechanical benefits, visual cues, and narrative weight to do the things that basically make you seem like you're from this outer plane or descended from this outer plane. That's effectively what they were. To give folks a little bit of history on these types of characters, back in third edition, when they first brought over the Forgotten Realms into 3.5, actually, I think that was technically 3.0 when the Forgotten Realms book came out. I'm not entirely sure on that. Somebody will have to check me. But they actually said, yes, look, you can play these things, but they're so much more powerful that you actually cannot play them at level 1. They start at level 3. Like, you call them a level 1 character, but their power level is like level 3. So you actually had to start them higher up on the experience chart. So if everybody in your party got 300 experience points and everybody else goes to level 2, your character 300 experience points does not get them to their next level because they start higher up or whatever. Basically, they had level advancements like that for several races, but Tiefling, ASMR, and a few others, Drugar, were the Snor of Nevelin, were among those that had those. Some were 2 levels, some were 3 levels. I can't remember which were which off the top of my head, but I loved that because that allowed you to say, yeah, these things are unbalanced, but they just don't start at the same level as everybody. Like, they start when everybody else is at a certain point.
Right.
So that's another avenue, is you could have them be – you can give them extra power. Maybe you don't want to give everybody a feat. You start them with that feat, but they start at 4th level, and that character just doesn't join the campaign till 4th level.
Yep. Yeah, and I think from a purely linguistic point of view, if it's a Norse-based campaign, I think they would have to be tieflings and not Asimar. I think that's, you got to go with the Germanic origin word there. I think that's just the bare minimum that you could do on that front. But I think that's a really intriguing option, because again, when you start talking about investing the character's lineage with those kind of very specific options, then what you're really pointing to is like that their origin is extraplanar, and that their origin is from beyond, kind of from the land of the deity itself. So I think that's a really intriguing option. I think that there's also some interesting narrative hooks that you can introduce when you do that too. Like when I was running my in-person campaign, there was an Asimar in the campaign, and the player knew that they were an Asimar, but the character did not necessarily understand that they were an Asimar, what that meant, or what their connection was. What they realized is that they were different from everybody else, right? That they had abilities which other people did not have, but they did not necessarily understand why they had them, so they didn't recognize the connection. And so there was a part in the game when they not only realized that they realized what their extraplanar nature was, but that they also realized specifically which deity it was that they were connected to. And it was like a whole thing. Like it was a whole like 4 or 5 session arc that the entirety of the party went through when this character found that out. Like they can be really super rewarding to go ahead and do that sort of thing. And so I think that's the story behind the story here that I want to share, is that whichever direction you go with all of these options, make it a little mysterious. Don't give them all the keys to the castle right up front, right? Make it a little bit mysterious. That's a rule that I think most storytellers should follow in general, right? Is that in general, when you use the game as exposition for details about the characters that are within it, don't necessarily reveal all the secrets. Maybe the characters don't know everything about their own nature or whatever, and they can learn them throughout. So use the game to expose secrets like that. And I think especially in a case like this, if the character is asking for something very specific, very powerful, and out of the box a little bit, use the game to go ahead and expose some of that stuff. Maybe their connection to the deity has some sort of in-game impact that isn't related to the character at all. Maybe there's a battle going on and the deity like freezes time to everybody except for the player, and then comes down and says, you're in the wrong place. You and your friends don't belong here, so I'm going to teleport you far away from this. And then all of a sudden, when the characters wake up, they're in a different place, and the only one that knows what happened is that PC. Stuff like that. Use the game to expose those connections, and that could, because that can transcend lineage, it can transcend class, it can transcend cool powers, whatever. That, I think, is the story within the story there. So
a couple things I hope the GM here really recognized is the player wanted something that connected with the game on a deep level. Celebrate that. You tried to work around the word reward, but I think what you were really trying to say is celebrate that.
Yeah.
Make that known. You don't have to let all the narrative bits be known, not all at once. You got to reveal that over time. We didn't know exactly what happened in that final battle that took place on Firefly back in the big war until several episodes in. But when you're watching Firefly in the correct order and you get to the battle of the valley, and forgive me for not remembering the name of the valley at this point, but when you get to that battle and you see all those things, like that would have fallen on deaf ears episode 1 or even 2. We had to get to know the characters and who they were before we got the reveal on what brought them to that point. And then everything that took place dramatically following that was deepened by that reveal. Serenity Valley. Thank you. Duh. Why did I not know that?
Yeah, how do we miss that one? That was
it's right there on the title card for crying out loud.
It's on the side of the boat.
That's, yeah. It's the name of the daggum movie. But it is important to note that those reveals piece at a time are great. And especially if you've got a party, if you're 5 or 6 people deep, everybody's got backstory. You don't want every first 2 sessions of your campaign to be, let's go through everybody's backstory so we can move forward. Droll. That's
right.
That's not what you want to do. You want to get into the action, get into the campaign, do that, and then have a scene or an adventure that brings back one or two of the characters back. Have a NPC come in that get a couple episodes later that brings in somebody else. That's really what you're looking for. Mini story arcs here or there that kind of reveal these pieces as we go.
Yeah.
So celebrate the players who bring that kind of narrative to your games. They're your best friends.
Oh, man.
You just got to really think about how you want to do that. Because honestly, you could take all of our ideas to answer this question and make a great character and a great addition to this game. You could take one of these ideas and make a great character and an addition to the game. It's all about that player's level of comfortability with what they want to play, what they're good at playing. Maybe they don't like sorcerers. Maybe they don't like all those classes. So then go the species route. Maybe they love all those classes, but they just want to play a human because they don't want to do anything out there. Fine, no problem. Let them do it the class route. Maybe they're all in. Then let them go all in. There's ways to do that, and I think we've discussed those and come up with some good ones. So love the question.
I had a thought while you were talking here, talking about tying it into their background and everything like that. And I want to borrow a little bit from our old LARPing days because in third edition Mind's Eye Theater, backgrounds were a very specific thing. They were a currency, but definitely a statistic that helped flesh out the character. And the most successful games took all of the backgrounds and things like that a player had and assigned an NPC to them specifically and said, if you have three police influence, here are the three police officers that you know that you can go ahead and call on for specific things. I wonder if there's some way in kind of still within the 5e engine to look at a background that you get and say, here's the mechanical ability, here's the feat that you get with it, here's a ribbon ability that comes with it, and say who's responsible for that particular thing. Do they get a +1 to their attacks because they trained with a swordsman, and here's the swordsman that they trained with? How did they learn the feat? Why did they learn the feat? Where did they learn the ribbon background? How does that factor into their basically make the background more than just like a mechanical background, make it part of their backstory, not just their background. So I don't know.
I don't think it's mechanically there, but I think storytellers such as you or I, and honestly, even Sign of Souls 1395, because he's asking this kind of question, correct? I think the idea is what you do is just what you said. You take a background. There are probably several that come to mind better than others, but you take Acolyte.
Sure. Soldier.
You take soldier potentially.
Noble.
Specifically, there's several nobles, but there's that one that gives you three retainers that comes to mind or what have you. They don't fight. They don't do whatever. You could do that. But essentially, you could simply say you have three non-combatant sidekicks that follow you. One of those could be an acolyte, one of those could be a chronicler, and the other could just be a domestic herald.
Every time they enter a room, they get heralded in.
Yeah. It makes me think about the guy with the coconuts there following Brave Sir Robin.
Exactly. Yep.
But essentially, you get these three sidekicks, non-combatant, because you don't want to take that shine away from your other players. But also, if you're playing that smaller group, maybe the soldier is potentially a combatant, right? Yeah. If you use the sidekick rules, you grab a stat block that's appropriate for the level of the characters. So it might be a half CR, it might be a quarter CR, may even be a one CR, whatever. Yeah. Take the stat block that fits. And then as the party levels, the sidekick levels and gets all the sidekick benefits per Tasha's as you go. And you could easily do that, right? They refer to him by his deific name, per se, and won't accept anything less. And they're not rude. They won't, like, stab somebody who ridicules him or whatever. You don't want it to take over the game. But you could absolutely do that. I think it'd be very thematic and very cool. And again, you have to measure that with the other players. You don't want to take away all that time. So keeping them non-combatants and keeping them out of the adventure part of the adventure. So they're more in the role-playing, non-combatant, okay, social aspects of the game, or the explorational aspects of the game would make a lot of sense there. But I think there's absolutely a way to do that. And I love that idea. So three great ideas on how to address this particular and specific question. Yeah.
All right, let's go ahead and step away then for a brief minute, go ahead and pay some bills, and then we'll come back to go ahead and tackle what we think is actually the question within the question. All right, we'll be right back.
Here at Tabletop Journeys, we've leveled up our game, and we're prepared to make your next roll legendary. We've just started a partnership with FanRoll Dice, and they have over 300 product options to choose from. Gemstone, metal, new liquid core dice, and so much more. Better yet, listeners to the Tabletop Journeys podcast can get 10% off on their orders when they follow the link below and use discount code PODCAST10. A portion of these purchases come back to us, and this is a great way for you to help support the show.
We are back. And Luminika, when you had first broached the topic here early in the show, you'd said that you thought that there was a question within a question. Maybe he was asking a kind of superficial question about what to do in that specific situation, but you thought that the deeper question there was, what do you do when a player is asking through their background, when they're making extraordinary claims in their background? Maybe not even necessarily asking for something like this, but either there's a remarkable amount of depth to their background, which may or may not jive with lore or history that has already been established within the world, or something like that. Am I getting the question that you wanted to go ahead and dive in there correctly? Is that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Sign of Souls 1385 did a great job for the question that they asked. But there's a deeper question that it brought to my mind that I think many GMs, especially not necessarily brand new GMs, because they may not get this if they're also dealing with brand new players per se. But I think GMs who've not been doing it for 30 plus years will come across this and might be stymied by this, because there's a lot of information on the internet that says, say yes and, very good advice. There's a lot of information that says, it's your world, do it your way, and make sure things fit thematically so everything makes sense internally. Also good advice. What does a GM do when they are given the absurd ask? What do they do to handle those weird outline questions that don't fit, that don't make sense, are really complicated, or what have you? And this can come to GMs in many ways, and I think we're both going to tackle them, but I'm going to go into one of the things that I have come across the most. And that really comes down to crazy options that I'm not familiar with. Look, there's a lot of material for D&D. There's a lot of material for 5e.
We write a lot of it.
We write a lot, right? Not everything in every supplement matches every game. One of the great things that WotC did was they created a core set of classes, a core set of subclasses, a core set of feats, a core set of features that, generally speaking, matches nearly every campaign world and campaign setup or style. Nearly. Very few exceptions that rule. The core stuff works pretty much everywhere. Once you get into Xanathar's and beyond, you start finding edge cases where things don't make sense, whether it be species, whether it be feats, whether it be subclasses, what have you, or subsequently even classes. I love an artificer. It's a great class. It doesn't fit in every game that I would play, however, right? Once you start dealing with that, for me, the question is, how do you navigate that when you've got a well-meaning player that is really hyped to play a thing and it doesn't fit your game thematically? A couple things you do. One, a lot of this is covered by your session zero, where you as a GM get to start by saying, this is the theme of my world. I'm really hoping everybody grabs things that fit that theme. As opposed to saying, don't do this, don't do that, give people a list that they can do. And I don't mean give them just a simple link. Talk about the options. look, the subclasses out of this book really fit this theme. That's where the inspiration for the campaign went on. These are the types of things that really dig in. Perhaps you give them a couple species for parts of the campaign world you've at least thought about. I'm not saying over prep your campaign world where you know every square mile, but I am saying have a general idea of what would work within your world and just say, hey, this kingdom is well received by the folks in the area we are starting in. So if you want to play a character who's well received, consider it a friend or an ally, you might want to play, but you don't want to play a human, you might want to select one of these species or select one of these backgrounds, what have you. So you can really do that. So it's less don't do and more it'd be wonderful if you did. So you're adding to the options versus subtracting from them. Mathematically, you're doing the same thing, but
sure,
it feels different at the table. And it definitely feels collaborative. If you give your table of six, 12 different options that work absolutely wonderfully in your world that you're excited and looking forward to, why would they want to go outside of that? Yeah. Likely, they're going to pick from those 12 options. You're going to end up with a better thing. So the way in which you present your options is really one of my big answers to that question.
Yeah.
How do you handle it? You got to get in front of it. You got to know what your ask is.
You said so much in there that has mercilessly snaked everything that I was going to go ahead and say. So I'm going to go ahead and touch on a couple of different points there that really form the highlights, though. The first thing is that you mentioned collaboration, right? I am very much a yes and storyteller, like at the end, especially in the character generation portion of things, especially early on. So that is absolutely my focus when we're building characters. When I'm crafting a game, want to know what the players want to play to go ahead and fill in the gaps that I have not decided on. That's how I want to go ahead and proceed down that path. Absolutely 100%. And I very much approach it with the same mentality that I do collaborative world building. Because here's the thing, collaborative world building does not work for every storyteller, even though they should all try it. And it doesn't work for every storyteller because it requires a little bit of the relinquishing of control of the world to people who are not you. So if you are a storyteller who needs to micromanage every detail, collaborative rule building may not be a tool that will work for you because it requires you to not be in control. If you can't deal with the fact that you're not in control, it's not going to work, right? It's not going to feel good to you to go ahead and do it. Or maybe you need to do it in small doses in small isolated areas. And by areas, I don't mean like physical areas on the map, like small areas of your story, mental areas of your story. Try it in like small areas to go ahead and let them flesh out one small piece of it that doesn't really impact the rest of your vision. But I approach character generation in the same way. I want to know what you want to play. And so I have the 30,000 foot view on what I want to run. I ask you to go ahead and tell me what you want to play. And that's like the lettuce on my BLT, right? Like I've got the buns. You're going to give me the lettuce. Then once you've got all that, then I'm going to go ahead and put the burger and the bacon on the sandwich to go ahead and make it a full-fledged meal. But whatever that lettuce looks like, whatever, is it romaine? Is it iceberg? Whatever lettuce it is it kale? Who knows, right? Whatever it's going to be, I'm going to let you pick the lettuce, right? But know that like I'm making the buns and I'm making the burger and the bacon, but the lettuce and the tomato, they're all yours. Whatever you want to go ahead and make, have at it. I will use that to go ahead and inform. If you go ahead and choose kale, maybe I'm not going to go ahead and choose like the apple smoked good bacon because the sandwich is already going to be ruined. So that's what I'm saying. So that's, that analogy broke down a little bit there, but you understand what I'm saying here is that I'm going to give you some control so that I can go ahead and fill in my gaps.
I absolutely get it. And the only thing I could think that could even possibly save kale on a sandwich would be one to slightly cook it and then for me to do my candied peppered bacon.
Yeah,
would sweeten it up.
Kale. I think kale has a pretty unique flavor and consistency that I like.
But like it raw. I actually like it cooked. That's the thing for me. You said something that was very important about collaborative world building not being for everybody and people need to figure out how and where. Everybody should try it. But if you're a person who really needs a whole lot of control, you might have to select where and how much you use that. And I wanted to touch on that because as a person who's learned great improv mostly from our LARP days and has very much embraced collaborative world building in my storytelling since we've started this thing 3.5 years ago. I also am a person, as I've talked about on the show, with ADHD. And there's oddly, this past week, there have been a number of different content creators, YouTube and podcasts, that have been talking about how folks with ADHD can and better work the hobby, the game, as both players and as GMs. Several luminaries, Ginny D, the Dungeon Dudes, and a few others that I've caught, have really had very informative discussions on the topic. And I watched all those very intently. And I will simply say that many of those things I have been using, I continue to use, and I have built through our experiences doing this. And with collaborative world building, for me to get used to doing it with my games and relinquishing a bit of that control that I perseverate on from time to time, that's a joke, all the time. For me, it is tightening up the either the number of options or where those options come into play.
Sure.
So our collaborative world building book, every table was 20 deep. I don't know how deep the Candlekeep one was. I assumed it was 20, but I don't honestly know that. However, when I ran chapter one of my Eberron adventure, I did two things differently. One, I prescribed a number of better choices for character types. And by that, I went out and purchased all of the NPC, pre-gen NPC pack for Eberron off the DM's Guild versus me making my own or whatever. I actually went with what was already there for the level. And this was a level one adventure. Got that to start with. But I knew many of the players that were likely to be at my table have never played in Eberron before. So without being able to control the character generation and have a huge 2-hour session zero to get them into it and get them into a campaign, we're at a convention. I've got 4.5 hours effectively to get the thing done from start to finish, including all the session zero bits, right? So what I did was I did a collaborative world building chart that was very tight. I think I had 12 options, not 10. No, I think I only had 10 options. And there were 10 reasons Eberron characters would have found to have been on that train.
Yep.
That way, every player, regardless of which character they took, I would have a reason to be on the train and connect them with the adventure. And I really enjoyed that. It's not something I even talked with you about, though as I wrote it and came up with it and just said, this is the time I'm going to run it, all I could think of when I did this was that, oh my goodness, Josh is going to be so proud of me for this chart and the way it comes out in game. And I was absolutely and thoroughly rewarded at the table with the folks I had playing my game. They really bought into that. And that was the core of their characters. Honestly, I don't think it mattered until towards the end of the campaign what character class they played. Honestly, it was their species, and it was that particular collaborative role-building role that masterfully steered the entire narrative through the adventure.
Yep.
Like, brilliant.
Yeah, that's why I find letting characters basically have free reign to decide what they want to be and what they want to do, why I find that so powerful. Because I don't know where the world is going to go necessarily. I have no idea. Could go just about anywhere. Think about what we did with Star Trek. Sure, the players, we knew what the Delamis Christian was going to be, but the players came up with all the shuttlecraft. The players came up with a lot of the details of the Delamis Christian. Think about how the engineering crew and the engineering department has been shaped by Tanari and how Dave plays him. There is a huge amount of player influence in how those things function, which is incredibly powerful. So I appreciate you realizing that. Yeah, like that's how I approach that. So the other thing that you said when we were talking about this a few minutes ago was that you had made the comment that the biggest secret is that you've got to stay in front of it. You can't be deciding after the campaign has begun or after gameplay has begun that there are background details that still need to be settled. That is absolutely the big takeaway I think that people need to go ahead and take away, is that make sure that character details are settled before the dice rolls begin. there are things that can happen to any character throughout a campaign, right? There are things that can happen that shape their attitudes on things or shape their perspective on things, or maybe if we're looking at like the new scar system in Star Trek or something like that, something that can shape their character throughout the game, right? There's all sorts of stuff like that that can happen, but it's really important, at least from my perspective, where character generation is an extension of my collaborative storytelling style anyway, it's really important that I know all of these things that are connected. And this is one thing that I really want to acknowledge Daggerheart for. Glenn is running a Daggerheart actual play. We did the character generation kind of bit of it a little while ago, and I was so super impressed by the way that they did their character connection bit. So I'm looking at my character sheet and I see three questions that I need to answer regarding everybody else at the table. Until we actually did it with everybody else at the table, I did not realize that the three questions that I had were not the same three questions that every character has. I thought everybody had to answer the same things. I was like, oh, these are awful specific. How is this going to work? I guess they're looking for a pretty particular set of narrative, right? And then as the questions began, I was like, oh, they've got different questions. Oh, and it was, I cannot wait until this comes out on audio, when Ari from Rainbow Dice Club and I were going through our characters, we realized that so many of our questions were like, you want to talk about yes anding. She'd asked me a question. I was like, oh, I know exactly the answer for that, because in fact, it's also going to mean that my next question is for you, because by answering your question, it has now exposed the question that I need to ask you, and they play off of one another. I don't think I have ever been through a connection building exercise like that before, except for, and this was in, it took way longer because it was basically through gameplay, but basically when we did the discovery system in the real thing, and how all of a sudden we started realizing all the connections between all these characters, it was like a microcosm of that that was distilled and happened during character generation. It was freaking brilliant.
So a couple things about that. Audience members, folks listening to this, if you want to hear more about this question asking and connection between player characters bit, let us know in the comments below. Hit us up, email all of the socials. Let us know, because I think it's a brilliant thing that we really need to really dig into. And I really want Glenn to be a part of that conversation, because it is something that he does exceptionally well. When I read about it, when we reviewed the initial beta, that it felt very similar to Powered by the Apocalypse, one of the influences for the game.
Very
and
much so.
Specifically, our experience with the real thing, which takes that out of the character generation process and puts it into the gameplay via discovery. But what I also noticed is that is a absolute factor in the Monster of the Week game.
Yep.
So having played that game with Glenn running it, he's one amazing at that. Oddly, some of the other Powered by the Apocalypse game, that was removed, and I think to their detriment now that I've seen it in action in other games, right? But it is very much that process of there's basically one question for every other player at the table. And you had to basically describe your connection with that. And there's a way to do that. So every playbook had a list of questions. You as a player got to select which question, and you as a player got to select which player you wanted to ask it of. And I thought that was absolutely brilliant. Absolutely. Just what we needed. And I think there's a lot of benefit to that. I think the answer for games that don't have that mechanic in it is effectively a mini collaborative world building table like you're known for, and just build that into your session zero.
Totally. Yeah. Collaborative world building is not something that we invented. It has its origins in a great many games like Powered by the Apocalypse. I didn't realize that Monster of the Week did that, though. That's awesome. And that's very similar to what Daggerheart did, where, again, you had a list of questions and you're supposed to go ahead and ask them to specific characters and stuff like that.
But definitely something we should come back to, because how we start up a campaign or how we start up an adventure, when you're looking at how do you write adventure hooks for your adventure that you're writing either for your homebrew table or for publication. Bob's your uncle.
Yeah.
Literally, you have to ask the question to decide who Bob is
and who Bob is and why he's your uncle. Exactly. Yeah, no, which side he's on. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, the things we talked about here were get in front of it, get things set up, know what you're going to do before you start rolling dice. Thank you, Josh, for that one. The other thing is be prescriptive. Add options so you don't have the need to deny other options.
Yeah.
Let people know what they can do and what will work best. And then they're much more willing to follow that lead. And the other thing is be open to maybe something you hadn't thought of. Don't just say no out of hand. There are going to be times where you may have to, but be open to the fact that maybe you could find a way to make that work.
Yeah.
Mull it over. Don't make a final decision. So have some of these thoughts and ideas before you sit down for the official session zero so you can have some idea of what you're going into.
Yep, exactly. And to go ahead and build on that a little bit, to go take it back to the original question that we started with, remember that there's more than one way to skin a cat, right? You can, if you have a character that wants something unusual, there are multiple ways to try to give them what they're asking for while also giving you resources that you want to go ahead and play with that character and play with that concept later. So there are multiple ways to go about that. So make sure to think about all of the rules that are available to you whenever you're dealing with that sort of thing. If they want to be the child of a deity, do you approach the lineage angle? Do you approach the class angle? Do you approach the Benny's angle? That kind of thing. Yeah. There you go.
Good job.
All right, let's take a look at the calendar here. So let's see. So right now, Preservations is on a baked-in four-week gap here between episode 3 and 4. Yeah. That's, I think there may be some shorts that come out in the next couple of weeks here, but it's a planned gap here while we build up some recorded material to go ahead and get us through the end of the year. So no worries about that. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with Preservations. But before we come back next Friday, we're going to have an awesome interview. I'm really looking forward to this. We're recording in a couple of days, but we have Lynn Codega coming on the show from TTRPG Rascal News. And of course, the infamous article that kind of launched the OGL discussion, so to speak, last year, and was of course written by Lynn. So very much looking forward to having them on the show to talk about what the heck is going on now. And I am sure that there will be some questions about how that little thing may have shaped the trajectory of their career or something like that. So really looking forward to that conversation. We'll be recording that in a couple of days, and that will be on next week's episode. But yeah, until then, I think that's about it. So
yeah, quick shout out and thanks again. I've said the name several times and I keep saying it in the hopes that maybe they'll find the show and chime in. Love the question. Love the topic. Really interested to see how they ended up going with this. But Sign of Souls 1395 on the r/D&D subreddit. Awesome. Thanks for asking a great question. Audience, questions like this, I know once a year or so we do questions from the audience as a big old show. Don't wait for that.
Yeah.
Send us your questions at the end of every episode. Did we miss something? Do we want to talk about something? Let us know.
Yeah. Do you disagree with how we would go ahead and handle the question in the first place? Please. We want to hear it. All about it.
You know. Is Josh full of it? Maybe. I didn't think so this time. Often. I'm just kidding. Let us know. We want to talk. We want to have a conversation. Hit us up on the Facebook group. We love y'all and can't wait for more.
Yeah. I'm full of it a lot. Let's be honest here. So anyway. All that said, good night, everybody. Thank you very much for listening. And we'll be back to you next week with our interview with Lynn Codega. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening. Appreciate it as always. And we'll talk to you then. Good night.
Good night, all.
Thank you for joining us. This has been Tabletop Journeys. We would love to hear your feedback on our show today. Join us at www.ttjourneys.com, where you can subscribe to the blog to leave comments and see all the content that we publish beyond the podcast.
You can also stay in touch by subscribing to our Twitter, Tumblr, or Instagram at TT Journeys, joining our Facebook group, Tabletop Journeys, or by sending an email directly to podcast@ttjourneys.com. Our full episodes come out every week on Friday, and every Tuesday features actual play and gameplay showcase episodes. Looking for early access? You can support the show and get episodes before everyone else at www.patreon.com/TTJourneys. Check it out today and see all the awesome benefits we bring to our supporters.
Lastly, if you're listening to us on Stitcher, iTunes, Podchaser, Spotify, or Audible, we would really appreciate it if you would like and subscribe to the podcast on that platform. Thank you for listening and for being a part of our growing community. And we bid you fair tides, friends, for Legends awaits.